right, gentlemen, so let's get this show on the road, shall we? Welcome, everybody, to episode number 20 of Behind the Shield. I'm your host, Marco Estrella, and I'm happy to be back behind the mic here to talk about, yet again, cybersecurity, our favorite topic. On today's show, Palo Alto deals with a zero day, a world-famous event gets scammed, and Roku gets rocked yet again. Also on the show today, we have a special guest. We have Bruno Germain of Zscaler, and he's going to be regaling us with a spotlight talk. He saw something that tickled his fancy there about SASE, Zero Trust, and SSE. So he's going to be talking to us. He read an article which he wasn't exactly on board with, of the same opinion. So we'll discuss about that a little later on. Welcome to the show, Bruno.
Thank you very much.
Can you introduce yourself to the audience? Just what's sure. Your title, what you do at Zscaler, a little bit of your background, please.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm a solution or transformation architect, depending on the day and who's heading our divisions. But and I cover large Canadian enterprise and public sectors. As early as 2008, I've worked on the development of standards for virtual networks. So MAC and MAX, short path bridging, some of these stuff, right? And I see as part of our audience here, there's a gentleman named Scott Cheval that was there and worked with Scott on these things at the time. So, hi, Scott. And later on in that journey, I joined Martin Casado and the Nicera team in 2012, introducing software-defined networking to North American enterprises and governments and stuff, you know, just about all around the world. The interesting thing about that piece of it was that it enabled Zero Trust. So Zero Trust, the paper from John Kittervogel, had already been out, but it was kind of hard to put in place, like putting micro-segmentation and things of that nature with physical firewalls all over the place, kind of hard. Virtualization enabled it, and all of a sudden it took it took a life of itself. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very lucky because for the last, 10 years now, I've been accompanying clients on their Zero Trust journey. And I've had the chance to also work with John Kindervag himself, right? So all of these things was like just being at the right time at the right place. And since then, I've worked with a number of manufacturers just before Zscaler was Google. So had the opportunity to play with different type of technology, all related to security and Zero Trust access or Zero Trust architecture. So hopefully this is going to be enough to have a good talk with you guys later on.
Oh, too. I'm sure it absolutely will. For sure. Well, welcome to the show, Bruno. Great to have you on the panel today. Well, Bruno will be on the panel, but you know them, you love them. We have our two regulars on the Hot Topic segment. We have Patrick Nahum, Virtual Guardian CEO.
Hi, everyone. Great to be back.
And direct from West Virginia, just landed a few hours ago. From Globetrotting, our Director of Customer Success, Jason Williams. How's it going, Jason?
Hello, everyone. Hello, Marco.
All right. So great. Let's get to a little bit of housekeeping, shall we? We have a live audience today. Quick reminder that if you want to ask questions to our panel today, to our spotlight guest, you can do so. Just put your questions in the QA section of the Zoom call. If this is the first time listening to the show, you want to catch up on past episodes, you can find them at our website, virtualguardian.com/events, or wherever you get your podcasts. So let's begin the show with our first order of business, our hot topics, and I drew the names out of a hat. And Jason, you're up to bat. Your first hot topic concerns Palo Alto and a serious issue they faced just this past week. What happened?
Yes. So Palo Alto had an exploit for their PAN-OS, and it was a critical vulnerability that was based on command injection in the Global to Protect feature. And it's very, very interesting with this type of attack because the adversaries, while they launched their attack, they had utilized files, system files, and named the same system files that PAN-OS utilizes for their systems to operate. And so the exact origins of the threat actor exploiting the flaw are pleasantly unknown, but Unit 42's tracking the malicious activity under the operation name of Midnight Eclipse. So you start to think about how sophisticated these attackers are coming into play now. You know, normally you see some obscure file being utilized, so a randomized number in a file, something that for threat hunters, for Sims, for, you know, Unit 42 and that type of caliber with, you know, whether manual or automated, it's sometimes pretty easy to determine what these what's happening, right? Or that there is something going on that really needs to be looked at. But now with this sophistication of an attacker like this, utilizing the same naming capabilities of system files, et cetera, that don't have any deviation to something that's unknown, make it really hard now to detect at that level. So the advancement of these adversaries is increasing. And I thought it was very interesting on that, you know, and utilizing a command injection to those types of files that actually could, you know, it was a feature of Global Protect that an unauthenticated attacker could weaponize to execute arbitrary code with root privileges. So you think code injection, normal command lines, normal file structure, and then being able to launch into the root privileges of a firewall kind of wreaks havoc across there. So while it didn't affect everything in the Palo Alto suite, it did affect certain firewalls with certain OSs that were running Global Protect, but still a pretty sophisticated type of attack against one of the premier security, vendors in the market.
Okay. What do you think is going to be the impact on Palo? Any impact at all? I mean, they're so huge.
I think it's not going to make that big of an impact on Palo, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But I do think it opens up the eyes to everyone that, you know, Palo leading the way in that security field for a long time hasn't really been on the block of released exploits compared to other vendors in the same market space. Mm-hmm. And then seeing this come into them with command injection, it's pretty interesting with this type of adversary.
Yeah.
I mean, a CVSS score was 10.0.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. We can't disregard. I mean, I asked the question in the sense that certain well-known logos have been hit recently. Microsoft, yeah. Just to, you know, not to name them, but not to harp on their misery. They get rocked, but they do get through it. I guess mm-hmm. Palo will be a little bit of the same. It's a giant, a little bit of a tarnish, but I think I agree with you on that, Jason. It won't be too bad, I think.
Do we have any indication of what their reaction was to this?
Right. Like public reaction?
Well, they're automatic. They already released mission critical vulnerability fixes for, and I'll tell you right now what files or what software.
From 10 on, actually 9.
Yeah, from 10 on, 10 to 11, keep going forward. That's right. So they were quick to address it and to fix that vulnerability. That the exploit came around the March timeframe of this year. So, but it's still proliferating and it's making it into the limelight of hacker, the hacker news, et cetera. But again, I think the biggest thing for organizations other than the fixes is you start to look at what Unit 42 is going to produce out of this. You take those IOCs that they've identified, and then you start mapping those IOCs in your environment to look for these types of things in the future. Because if they can make it past that caliber of a control, utilizing these types of obfuscations very easily, it's something to look for inside the environments, you know, so you don't go down the log4j route and things like that have happened in the past.
Absolutely. I think
it's also an indication, and maybe I'm wrong here, and would be good to have your feedback on it, as software complexity and service complexity grows, and companies like mine or Palo Alto basically acquire, you know, a third party to accelerate the development of features, you have an N square problem, or at least a logarithmic problem of testing and QA and all of these things to be done inside of your software suite, right? So we were just talking, or at least there was a mention of Microsoft. Microsoft is at the other end of the scale. Like, I mean, the complexity of Azure, the complexity of the product, we're not surprised to see vulnerability every week coming out of there, right?
Agreed.
And as some of our companies and some of our products, especially being transformed as platforms also, right? And you're transitioning from one model of deployment to another type of different type of operation to another type of operation. You know, I think these things are going to become more common. And then again, not to jump to my topic, but the whole idea of zero trust is that you have to accept that any of these pieces are going to die. You have to start.
Right.
You have to start your architecture by thinking that none of this is 100% fail safe, right?
100%. Yep.
So that's the assumption. So,
and it's not just at the design level and the vulnerability level are being exploited. It's also at the usage level, right? Because to your point, software has become so complex. And if you look at Microsoft, there's so many different ways to do the same things that it's also how users or administrators interact with the software with the normal features that could expose risk and expose to vulnerability. So you have two layers, right? You have the development layer and vulnerability is exposed there, but also how you use the software and the potential exposure you could create just by misusing what's out there. And to your point, Bruno, they're platforms. So platforms by definition mean that there's a lot of interactions going towards the platform. So you could easily have a ripple effect on threats and exploits from a usage perspective or an actually design perspective. So it's even worse when you think about it.
And you look at, like we talk about the sophistication now and adversaries using, we've talked about it, I mean, on numerous podcasts, BTS podcasts, which is AI moving forward and utilizing that to make sure that they don't have mistakes that can be identified. Because before, there were so many mistakes in some of the code. There were hints. There were different attributes that you could look at to reverse. Those types of things are getting harder and harder now as their sophistication grows, utilizing things like AI that help them to be more that basically just make it so you can't easily just say, oh yeah, there's a mistake, let me just get out of this. So I guess the easiest way to put it. But the sophistication is there and growing across these adversarial groups now.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for your input on that one, on the first one. We're going to move on to our second hot topic, which belongs to Patrick. Patrick, you and I both reside in the city of Montreal. Bruno, are you from Montreal as well?
Yeah, I'm just outside nowadays. I've moved out in the Eastern Townships, but I am
Eastern Townships. Okay. So we're all three very close to the city of Montreal. So this next topic kind of near and dear to our heart. So a world famous event, actually, which I grew up with anyway, in the city. Tell us about it, Patrick. What happened?
Never trust. Always verify. Have you adopted a zero trust security framework? Do you require all users, whether in or outside your network, to be authenticated, authorized, and continuously validated to get or keep access to your applications and data? Only the paranoid survive. So keep your intellectual property safe with a zero trust attitude. Contact ESI at info@esitechnologies.com or visit esitechnologies.com.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate development. The Just for Last festival, actually. It's a current, you know, when I look at stories and see how we could take advantage of some of those stories to better educate people, this came up, and obviously it's a recent story. So obviously, Just for Laughs actually was created in 83. I looked up a little bit of their history. In 1983 in Montreal, it was in French, Juste pour Rire festival. And over time, it's become an international operation. I mean, you see Just for Laughs everywhere. I mean, I go in an airport in some random spot and look at the screens and you had
the gags,
exactly.
The gag, yeah.
Whatnot. A lot of comedians' careers were launched through the Just for Laughs festival here in Montreal. And we've had also notables like Jerry Seinfeld gave some shows here as well. It's really an international event. And the pandemic really, really hurt them a lot. So they're very close to receivership. They actually canceled for the first time ever the Montreal Just for Last Festival, notwithstanding the pandemic period there. But they've suspended the festival for this summer because of financial difficulties. And add insult to injury, as they're scrambling for the survival of the business, it was also discovered that they were victim of a business email compromise fraud last year to the tune of more than $800,000, which is like north of 10% of the debt they're incurring right now and that they're trying to scramble to minimize and survive, make the company survive. And I'll give you a little details on how it happened. And hopefully from there, once again, because we hear these stories on a regular basis, you know, we've have customers or new customers calling us to help out, is essentially something that unfortunately keeps happening. So February of last year, so Just for Last Festival deals with a company called Spectra Group CH, which is owned by the Molson Company, which also owns the Montreal Canadiens, and Eventco, which is an event management company. So they were interacting together and their suppliers. And in February of 2023, someone sent from Spectra, they were unofficially from Spectra, sent an email to, as we usually find out, to change banking information for fund transfers to someone from the Just for Last Festival. $8,600 transfer. And it was done with the financial controller at the Just for Last Festival. March, $209 were transferred to another the bank account with instructions to change accounts. And obviously, after two successful transactions, the last one being $209, the last one was at $804,000 and north of $800,000 in April. And it's when the CH group called to collect that they realized, you know, Just for Laughs said, well, we paid you already. And that's obviously the rest was history. So unfortunately, it happened to them back then. It's another case of fraud. In this case, you know, a very high level fraud, a lot of money was involved in a situation where the company was already in difficulty. So you could imagine that. And you know, and it's often believed, and when you research this a little more, and I've said this in a couple of occasions, but I went to get recent data. You know, people think that ransomware are the forms of attack that generate the biggest losses in North America. It's actually not the case. Mm-hmm. It's business email compromise to the tune of $2.7 billion. And I went to the Internet Crime Report from the FBI 2022, which is just in the US, and obviously only for reported frauds, because most people do not report. So in the report, it indicated that there were 21,000 claims for fraud, for business email compromise fraud, versus 300,000 phishing attacks. Typically, phishing attacks will lead to ransomware attacks. Business email compromise more in the spear phishing, you know, very directed interactions with customers and customers or victims, sorry. And ransomware was reported by the FBI during the same period of time in 2022 to account for 34 million. But that does not include loss of revenue, of course, the damages incurred with your breach coaches and insurance companies and everything else you have to do around that. But we're looking at 2.7 billion business email compromise versus 34 million. By the way, the ransomware, the amount declared in the report was declining. Business email compromise has been increasing in a big way over the same period of time.
Really?
And people underestimate that, right? Because it's under the radar. We're taking a bit of money from here, a bit of money from there. And when you look at, even if I compare to ransomware, it's, in my opinion, a little easier with a little more work to protect against business email compromise. Because if you look at what happens, you know, and as at the same time, I'm going to discuss, you know, what are the basic hygiene is necessary. So the worst case scenario is someone taking someone's email account, impersonating someone's email account within the company. In order to protect against yourself against that is obviously MFAs, right? So that's the number one thing. But in this case, specifically, it was a spoofing attack. So we added the hacker added an S to Spectra. It was Spectra's. But that is typically done after intelligence gathering, right? You have people calling you, emailing you. They're trying to understand what the work patterns are, who's in charge of collections, who's in charge of receivables. And then they map out how the organization works, and the attack is taken over a certain period of time. So MFA will protect you against the ultimate attack, which is literally impersonating someone within the company. But when it's from the outside of the organization, now, we often forget, basic training is the number one thing, right? It's not tools. It's not spending millions of dollars on software, although software is part of the solution. I'll get to that in a minute. But it's all about educating people and validating the identities, right? And it's going to tie into what Bruno's going to talk about. You know, one of the premises or principles of zero trust is least privileged access, or validate everything, make sure you authenticate everything at all times. So validating by a phone call, double checking, it's a process issue, it's a training issue that you need to have within your organization. The other aspect, yeah, software is part of it, business email compromise software, but the more advanced software that leverages AI to understand how your company behaves, what the exchanges are, how transactions are conducted, to be able to detect those anomalies. Those are other layers of security you need to put in place. And guess what? We're also looking at analog solutions. Why not put in place? And I'm looking at this with our kids at home and in other scenarios. We have it with our alarm system, right? If you're getting an alarm and the company's calling you, they typically ask us for a password that only we know, to make sure that it's not the attacker or the burglar that's there and just answers, yeah, everything's fine, we're in the house, and that's it, right? They don't recognize our voice. We have a password. So same thing for specific maybe transactions over a certain level. Enable verbal confirmation of specific passwords, that a control message between two humans, if you will. And I'm not even talking about, voice impersonation with AI, which has also happened, and even videos. There was a famous case recently, someone was on a call and all the employees around the call were all AIs, but essentially the person that was compromised couldn't tell. So that's another level. But at the very basic, we have to go back to a bit of more process training, analog, with a minimal layer of security and strong authentication. And it'll go a huge way to address these issues that still happen on a regular basis, especially in companies that have a lot of transactions, a lot of suppliers, and a lot of stakeholders. So I wanted to report that it's a company that's here, it's international, but close to home, that's having difficulty, and this happens, and it's so avoidable.
Yeah, it might be the nail in the coffin for this event with everything. They've had some trouble with management. It was very public stuff with the management of the show. Pandemic almost killed the festival. It was canceled a couple of years in a row. And now this could be the final. Hopefully not. It's a great festival. It's about a month out of the year. It's right before the Jazz Fest, or right after the Jazz Fest. I forget which, but in the middle of the summer, downtown Montreal. It's a good time. Lots of free shows on the street. It's a shame. It's a shame to see these things happen. And then, when it hits close to home, you kind of feel worse. But just it happens to businesses everywhere, and they shut down. And when we say that these companies go bankrupt, it's not hyperbole. It's unfortunately businesses do shut their doors. It's a shame. Thank you, Patrick. Very interesting. Let's move on to our third hot topic. Jason, you had a second one about Roku. That got rocked. Roku is a bit more popular in the US than in Canada, I think, in my opinion. I know of Roku, but I think in the US it's much more widespread than here. What is Roku exactly, just for the benefit of our Canadian listeners, and what happened?
Yeah, so Roku is basically similar to the Netflix of the world and things like that. It's a streaming service that you subscribe to. You have different options in there that you can purchase from, et cetera. So what happened was, earlier this year, Roku had a breach that happened that basically compromised about 15,000 accounts. Not too bad. Yeah, I mean, it's a bad, but not too big compared to their footprint of, I think, 80 million subscribers, et cetera. Wow. Okay. But so you look in perspective of that.
Yeah.
But when you start to look at how they were going through, how that breach occurred, et cetera, they found out a secondary breach that actually compromised 576,000 accounts. And it was, so we just talked about, and not to digress, but we just talked about business email compromise and these rudimentary attacks that are still generating a lot of revenue. This one utilized something called credential stuffing, which, you know, you look at credential stuffing, you look at the identity side now of security, and we need to, we're growing further and further into the identity analytics to be able to determine attacks and to prevent attacks and be proactive. But they did credential stuffing, and they found accounts that were utilized utilizing additional credentials from various sites. They went in and started pounding against these accounts and were able to compromise those accounts. Now, it's kind of interesting when you think about that, because did they compromise 576,000 accounts by cred stuffing 576,000 times? Kind of weird, right? That you would be coming in to all of those accounts and compromising them. So the Jersey side of me, while I'm eating my New York style pizza, which are the big slices that we actually fold here in the States, and get that down, you're kind of going through that and you're like, okay, cred stuffing from, and you get access to one account. That's pretty good. Okay. What are you going to do with it? Make some fraudulent purchases, et cetera. But 576,000 that you cred stuff, a little bit different, because Roku was saying, we didn't have an account compromise internally that attributed to the external account compromise. So starting to look a little bit deeper into there, and I think we'll see some more information coming out on how these attacks actually happen. But in light of that, and we get towards the evaluation that they're looking through their environment, credit card information wasn't stolen, et cetera. So they're doing their due diligence from that side to make sure that some of that information that could really impact users, except for a couple fraudulent purchases, wouldn't affect them as much and, you know, change accounts. But to what Patrick was saying earlier about the 101s of security, they're now implementing 2FA on these accounts. And so you look at that and you're like, that should be standard. And so you, and to Bruno's point earlier, you look at zero trust architecture, you look at the way we build lines, lines of defense in depth across a security program. Multi-factor 2FA is the foundational. And these are where organizations need to really get to, whether they're organizations that are being subscribed to, like a Roku or a Netflix, et cetera, but also organizations across the board. We really need to be focused on helping them, as well as them doing their due diligence to implement those 101 controls that can minimize some of these types of attacks. Because cred stuffing, a little bit different than cred dumping, which is when you get in there and you can actually dump the credentials that you have, and now you're going in the reverse model. The cred stuffing is a little bit easier to defend with by utilizing 2FA, because then you get around the folks that that want to use the same password across 50,000 accounts.
So Jason, so let me understand this. Roku has been around for years. They have millions and millions of subscribers, and until just recently, they had no MFA.
They didn't have 2FA on their accounts, correct?
All right.
They didn't have, so right now, I mean, Roku said it had enabled two-factor authentication for all accounts and reset the passwords of those affected by the cyber attacks.
Wow. When we talk, I mean, it's kind of like the building blocks. It's the ABCs. We always, strong password. Okay. I mean, that's so old school, strong password, but MFA is right there. It's always right there. Wow. I'm surprised. But they're
saying over, 80 million users. Just confirmed that. And their systems weren't compromised, but it's just interesting on a cred. I'm just so perplexed on the credential stuffing and being able to access that many accounts. It's just it's very interesting to me. The spidey senses go up.
So they probably compromised an account that had access to everything.
That's right.
They stuffed the right account. Brutal, credentials.
But the way it reads is they compromised a user account, and you're like, well, how did the user account have access to that type of account?
Yeah.
It's still interesting on the information coming out from some of these attacks, but I thought it was interesting on the mechanism of the attack and the response of reset passwords, enable 2FA, and you go, man, we're in 2024. Exactly. We should be implementing these controls across the board.
Do you need to report a cyber threat? Virtual Guardian's emergency response team can take immediate action. Responding and recovery are vital to ensure your business critical services are maintained. Visit virtualguardian.com and click on Report a Cyber Threat in the upper right-hand corner. Or call us at 1-800-401-TECH. That's 1-800-401-8324.
Okay, so next
one. I like your Roku. I subscribe to you, but we got to have that across the board.
Are you, did you receive a letter from them saying, dear Mr. Williams, we're sorry?
Nope. No.
So you're not.
But I will tell you that on the AT&T side of the house, on that compromise, I have had a tremendous increase in spam messaging and my LifeLock alert going off a little bit. So I think that that was more related to, you know, my accounts on the AT&T side than the Roku side.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Bruno, Pat, anything to add? Good.
No, it's always around the same themes, unfortunately, basic hygiene.
Anyways. So next month's show, Jason, whenever you have any news on this and an update on how they got those 576 million accounts, let us know.
I agree with Jason. There's something wrong.
There's here. Something weird.
In the sense that you normally have a privileged account that accesses a number of things. You don't have a number of unprivileged account that basically destroys the entire thing, right? It's right. Kind of like backward. There's something that just doesn't jive in the way this is reported, at least.
Stay tuned, everybody. In the future episodes, I'm going to make it a point of revisiting this Roku story just to see what exactly happened. Thank you very much, panel. That was very interesting stuff. Just a reminder, if there's any questions and comments, please put them in the Q&A section of the Zoom interface.
That could be hockey playoffs as well, folks. Feel free to ask questions.
Oh, well, yeah, we're big hockey fans.
I opened the door for that one. I walked right in.
Everybody can ask questions except our regular panelists, which is not here today, Bill.
And got a smiley face.
Bill's already in the chat. He's ready. Okay, thank you very much, panel, for all those hot button topics. We're going to move on to our spotlight guest, Bruno Germain. Bruno, you disagreed with a recent article that you read about SASE, Zero Trust, and Security Service Edge. The next 15 minutes are yours. We're going to stick around and have a conversation about it. So please go ahead. Can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, like I said at the beginning, I've been at this for more than 10 years now, right? So I was very, very lucky just to be there when it started. But one thing that Zero Trust been plagued with, like any new shiny object, is that everybody and their mother at some point, you know, once they understood the concept, said that their product or what they were doing was Zero Trust. From people doing NAC to, you know, identity providers, whatever, right? Everybody across the board did that. And unfortunately, that whole architecture and mindset and movement toward a better architecture suffered from that misinformation, if you wish, right? So putting that into context and then having Forrester, a few weeks back, like maybe a month and a half back, issued their wave report. And part of the wave, you have to realize that Forrester, John Kindervag was at Forrester. He's the one that basically developed the Archer, actually put it out there as a paper, right? And basically stated that this was a better way of doing security. And after that, when John left, Chase Cunningham, right, that came from the U.S. Intelligence side, took over, and there's a whole team there. So they've been at this for a long time, and they issued their wave report, which is a snapshot of where things are. And basically now having marketeers, I guess, wanting to do a bit of mileage on the report, coming out basically stating in a very shiny little title there, right, that SASE is future, Zero Trust is past, and SSE is right now. I was kind of looking at it, like, what the hell, right? Again, here we are muddying the water and having non-initiated people, good-willing people that do want to do security the right way, thinking, you know, reading this and all of a sudden saying, oh, geez, I don't have the right tools. I don't have the right approach. Potentially, the roadmap I've had for my enterprise or for my department is wrong now, right? And I have, when actually the report doesn't state that at all, right? Mm-hmm. At all. Mm-hmm. So that's where I got a rash when I saw that, right? And again, the interesting piece of it is that if you go through the time of reading the report, the first piece of it, they basically acknowledge that technology changes over time, which is great, right? I mean, and that's absolutely true. If we go back at the early days of Zero Trust and you look at the original drawings, for instance, or design concept that John put out, it was all about MCAPs and security gateways. So MCAPs, micro segmentation, right? So micro perimeters. And then you had that huge firewall that did layer sevens in the middle that basically all the traffic went through. That was kind of the general idea of how you deployed it. No notion of users, no notion of data, no notion of posture, no telemetry, no, like it was a very basic idea to begin with, right? Fast forward 2023. Right. And actually 2021, when it first issued, but the second version came out, NIST, right, issued a framework and a reference model. Right. So there's no arguments anymore about what it should be. You know, I could have my own opinion and every vendor could have his own opinion, but there is now a reference architecture. There is a reference model to refer to. And that model still, microsegmentation is still part of it, if you wish, but there's a policy engine in there, and it basically stated that it starts with identity and posture of the equipment that you're using, right? So there's a different number of elements that weren't there at the beginning that are there today. Coming back to the Forrester report, Forrester acknowledges that these things are moving. And what they're saying is that it used to be that people would buy, you know, solutions like equipments or whatever, and with this idea of doing, you know, part of sections of what Zero Trust could deliver to them. But the idea here is that what they're saying now is that just if you just did SD-WAN in the past, mm-hmm. and you've basically put at the end of this a few security, you know, functions like an IDS, a firewall, whatever it is that you wanted to put at the end of that tunnel, with this idea of SASE, if you wish, what they're saying is that, well, that's not enough, right? And that is passé. That's not how you should envision accessing, you know, SaaS services or public services in general. There should be more to it, right? So they're talking about, you know, SWIGs and a bunch of other technologies. And who knows what the future technologies are going to be, but they're basically saying is like, it's dynamic in nature. There's platforms involved and the nature of what we can do is more than URL filtering now. So like, I mean, you need more, right? So mm-hmm. they're acknowledging, and that's basically like, if you look at the summary part, they're basically saying this. And so what they're saying is that you should move on. You should think of it in a more larger way, right? And they basically break that down in three pieces, right? So what you should be looking at should be offering a full set of services, not just connectivity, not just a firewall at the end of it, not like it should include, you know, a cloud access security broker. It should have a SWIG in there. It should have a bunch of stuff, right? So it's more of a platform now, right? And if you put it into a ZTNA model, well, it should also have that policy agenda, telemetry, you know, the ability of putting identities to it and everything else. There should be a notion of data also in there, right? So SD-WAN in itself, for instance, has no notion of data. It's like bytes going in, bytes going out.
That's right. Yep.
So what they're saying is that no, if now you're thinking about this, you should definitely talk about DLP, right? You should look at data and what data goes out, what data goes in, who accesses that data, all that type of information, which is also part of the NIST model, right? It's one of these components that NIST basically says, if you're going to do Zero Trust, you have to look at your data now. It's not just about the perimeter, right? And the last piece is that, well, it's not going to be a one size fit all. right? So you're going to have people, that are nomads across the world. Some organization might have, a footprint in China and need to deal, for instance, with the Great Firewall there, right? Or some people have barbed wire because they're in Africa and that's the only thing they can connect to. And all these things should be able to morph and be able to adapt, right, to where you need to be. So the report in itself is really, really good. I just thought that the title totally missed the point. And again, misled, our customers and the people that are willing to change and move and pivot from traditional security to the new one as, okay, go and buy this. Like when you're going to do your RFP, don't put SASE anymore, right? Put SSE, right? And you're going to be good and you're going to be covered, right? And that's where I kind of cringed and where I got that rash.
I got Vince Amutis. Apologies if I didn't say that wrong, saying in the comments, preach, Bruno, could not agree more. So there you go. You have some people that definitely agree with you. So hey, Vince. Thank you, Vince, for the comment.
We've met.
You've met? Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Question for Bruno. Bruno, obviously there's a big temptation from some customers, or actually I wouldn't say temptation. I'd say sometimes there's pressure from certain vendors to, go the ZTNA route. Our solution is a zero trust solution, right? I mean, in reality, it could be a component of a zero trust architecture, as we know, and as you've mentioned. If you're a customer that's, that understands that it's a framework, it's an approach, it's a target architecture, how would you recommend they go about starting the journey to zero trust? What have you seen? What are your recommendations to get things rolling for a customer that really understands this, that it's a framework and not a set of solutions?
There's a number of ways of going at it, right? But one of the starting blocks, and we touched on it in the various topics we spoke indirectly previously, is the notion of identity and posture, right? So in a zero trust model nowadays, and the difficulty for most client is that for 30 years, we've been doing security with two main ideas. It was infrastructure based, right? So mm-hmm. You came from this VLAN, you came from this IP pool, you came from, there was some kind of misguided association, right? There's no notion in IP that, 192.168.1.10 is Bruno. Doesn't exist. There's no RFC that basically says that, right? Okay. We build VPNs, for instance, where once I'm authenticated, I fall into an IP pool, and that IP pool represent HR. And from that point on, I just do, I just do lists of IPs. Mm-hmm. I've lost my identity, right? So identity needs to be carried around. So the good news is that, there's a number of tools out there, but most people have standardized on AD. And it's a great place to start, right? Because from MFA certificates, all type of authentication on background, Kerberos, NTLM, whatever it is that you want to do, you have that kind of front end that you can query now. And basically it will tell you, yes, it's Bruno. Right, with a valid, a certain level of confidence that it is me. Right. Now, the second piece of it, which also maps to the NIST zero trust model, is that, my device is my device providing me the right posture. Does it give me enough? Is it clear enough for me to use to access specific type of services? Maybe sometimes it's great, maybe sometimes it's not. So Bruno using his laptop, which is secured, blah, 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 client, et cetera, everything else, versus his iPad, same identity, different posture.
That's right.
Right? So maybe I don't have access to the same thing. So the first part is that, right? You need to work on that aspect. But the good news is that because we sent everybody home during COVID, a lot of the base work was done, right? A lot of like EDRs have replaced AVs, you know, management of endpoint has been implemented because they're not, you didn't have somebody in the office that basically could go to your laptop. So mm-hmm. all these tools have started to, you know, as a side effect of COVID, started to take place. Great. Like, I mean, the starting point is good. The second fallacy that we need to address, and is harder, is this idea that we need to be right all the time. Mm-hmm. So we've had that concept in security where unless you're right all the time, we fail. And
right.
it's proven
right.
time and time and time again that this is an impossible task to do. The thing with Zero Trust is that you have to accept failure, and the system has to survive with failure. So even though my identity has been compromised, right? That doesn't mean that all the services I have access to have been compromised necessarily, right? Because mm-hmm. I should be allowed yeah. to each services independently. Validation should be done each time. Session monitoring, retroaction, feedback loop with telemetry should be put in place so that if the condition change over time, that is dropped. So the system is not entirely failing because my identity has been compromised, or my laptop's been compromised, or the server's been compromised, or the network's been compromised, right? So it's kind of a partial failure. And then it becomes this idea of how do I get the telemetry necessary for me to actually have an action, be aware of mm-hmm. it, and then pivot and mitigate it. So changing that mindset is hard, because that we've been trained to not fail, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it's a hard concept to basically say, like, it's hard enough to basically go from physical security and infrastructure-based security, perimeters and all, to basically say, well, okay, we're going to pivot. This is going to become soft. That perimeter might exist, you know, in a number of places and everything else. But it's okay, you know, like it's okay that this guy gets compromised, or it's okay that he goes there, or that this particular piece fails, right? It is a hard change, but if you accept that, then you can start building the blocks with the proper guardrails, right? And that's what Zero Trust brings, right?
Right.
And if you start, so coming back to your question now, Patrick, that was kind of a big detour, but low-hanging fruit often, right? And that's where I think why ZTNA has been so popular and is still popular, is that the first vector of attack is normally not internal. I'm not saying that mm-hmm. there's not internal attacks. That's not what yeah. I'm saying. I'm right. saying the email, the phishing, the mm-hmm. all these other things are normally external to your organization, yeah. right? So
APIs nowadays.
So if you're capable of mitigating that vector of attack, right? That external vector of attack. So mm-hmm. SaaS services, public services, access to, and how data transfer and what you're sharing across these things and how these things come back to you and all of these things, you're already ahead of the curve, right? You have a long, I'm not saying there's not more work to be done. And in the process of doing this, you do put in place the policy engine, telemetry, and all the basic framework around this. Yep. You're so ahead of the game. You're
That's right.
ahead of the game, because then everything else is just a destination. Azure is a destination. GCP is a destination. Internal resources are the destination.
Yeah.
It's just a different True. Destination to all of this.
Is your company digitally resilient? 75% of small businesses have no disaster recovery plan, and backup copies do not guarantee an organization's ability to get back to business. For more than 25 years, ESI Technologies has specialized in IT continuity, reducing financial and operational impacts for our clients. Learn more about digital resilience from ESI's experts at esitechnologies.com.
How critical in your mind is identifying the data paths, the flow of data, and getting to a data-centric model when you're talking about ZTNA, et cetera?
I think it's central. I think it's yeah. central. The issue there that I find mm-hmm. when I'm talking to client is that all DLP projects in the past have had SIs coming in and basically say, oh, we need to categorize all your data. You need to tag them. You need to do this. And again, yep. go to Azure, for instance, the whole framework is about go and revisit your data at rest and do the tags. And
never ending process.
And it becomes that black hole that you never exit from, right? Yeah,
that's right. And then how do you map it to a user access? At that point, you're like, oh, come on.
So what is happening slowly on that front is, first of all, try to get visibility to it, right? So again, in a zero trust model, you should see all the flows. Great place to start doing this, right? If you're inspecting all the traffic from your users and between your servers potentially, right? But you have a place, a platform, an area where you have full visibility of all the potential exchanges. You can decrypt at scale to actually see which document is actually going across or not. And if you're capable of doing all these things, then you have visibility. Visibility is 80% of the job done, right? Because then at that point, right? At that point, you can start saying, okay, I can regroup these things in such a way. There's these types of documents. There's these types of depot. And you can start architecting something around this, right? The second aspect too is that I think it was John Maslow that said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, all your problem looks like nails. So so the other error that we do is we normally give the DLP portion to a specialized team, and they're out and they go out and they go and hunt for the perfect DLP tool. Not bad. And they're specialists, and I'm not putting down what they're doing. What I'm saying is that why not clean it up first, right? So the thing is that if I'm going to be sending traffic to a number of websites, maybe there's some website I should never be sending traffic to, or no data, right? Let's clean that up. Basic URL filtering, basic tenancy model. There shouldn't be any files larger than this going out. There shouldn't never be any PDFs or whatever that we should be exchanging with these
types. You need to inspect the traffic to figure that out, right?
Agreed. Zero trust, right? Look at the traffic, inspect it. That's a whole toast. And you have visibility to it. So let's say you cleaned all this up, right? Then what's left to do in DLP becomes smaller.
That's right.
Right? And you're not trying to solve everything in DLP with DLP tools, even though it should have been done in URL filtering, should have been done with a proxy, should have been done with file type, you know, whatever, right? So there's a way of bringing this to a size which is manageable.
That's right.
Just an ordinary client and not all the time specialists with an army of people.
And I think that's across the board. I mean, you talked about identity. How many identity projects start without an AD cleanup? And you're like, why? Look at the scope here. Look at the orphans, et cetera, on one of the biggest projects. But I don't know. I have to tell you, I think I'm going back to my token ring and Fiddy environment because I never had these problems back in the day, folks.
I can actually bring you back to TTY and the quick jump, brown fog jump over the lazy dog. But anyway, that's a different direction.
Right. Come on, Vince. I thought I'd get a response on Fiddy from you from that one.
Zero trust. Where do you, can you give me a sense of the adoption rate, Bruno, in Canada versus maybe US or Canada enterprise? Is it being adopted en masse, or is it, are we at 10%, 1 out of 10?
I couldn't tell you exactly the percentage. I don't know. I'd be sticking my finger out without knowing. What I do know is when we started, like way back in 2010, 2012, around that area, right? The traditional vendors were pushing back. Right. This is a theoretical model, never will happen, blah, blah, blah. We've passed that hump, right? Nobody's arguing about that anymore, right? Then it was kind of like that, my product does this, my product is, you know, zero trust, whatever. This is also gone slowly because NIST put out its reference model. The US has an executive order from the White House 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, basically stating that all federal agencies in the U.S. shall be adapting to zero trust in order to enhance their security posture. Everybody needs to move to zero trust. That's an executive order from the president, right? Canada's following suit. There was a zero trust architecture board for the federal government in Canada. I've participated to that too. Like It's more now of a matter of implementation. Coming back to COVID, and it's kind of a detour to answer your question there, Marco, we had to send everybody home. All of a sudden, everybody's flow that used to go through our stack that was in a centralized data center, we had no visibility. We didn't know what people were doing anymore. They were home, right? And they were sending stuff to office. They were sending stuff here and there, their emails. None of that was being transited through our data center anymore in our stack. So ZTNA, at least to our solutions to actually regain control on those flows and have visibilities on these flows, have come a long way. So Zero Trust as a full-blown architecture, not sure that many people have it. Not sure. Right? Microsegmentation, a bunch of for east-west traffic and data centers, a bunch of people have done that. And, you know, VMware, Illumio in the cloud. Like, there's a number of vendors that had sexy, you know, ACI, for instance, you want to do it in Fabric. There's a number of people that have had solution, right? But otherwise, the ZTNA portion, so the user piece to access the data, that has come a long way. That has just because of the fact that we needed to ship everybody out of the office, right? So the ZTNA portion is doing well and is well underway, right? The back end part, I still think we're struggling because we still have to depart from our perimeter based security.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Very, very interesting talk, Bruno. Thank you very much. We're running out of runway. Before the hour. So before we go, I want to thank our regular panelists, Patrick Naum, Jason Williams, for all their insights. A big thank you to you, Bruno, for joining us today, Bruno Germain, and all your time preparing that that interesting talk for us and our audience. And a sincere shout out to our sponsor, show sponsor today, Zscaler. Thank you very much. Your contributions, very helpful to the show.
I was going
to
say Zscaler for a moment there.
You know, I have about 20 post-its around my screen with Z-E-E, so I don't forget. It's not Zscaler for today's show.
Us Canadians, right?
Folks, that's the cred stuffing. That's his password, all right? So.
Bruno, as usual, very well explained. You're an artist.
Yeah, it was very clear. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh, I got a little comment here. Scott Cheval from the audience. Thanks for the session, folks. First time listeners. Scott, thank you very much. As a matter of fact, I was just about to thank the audience because it's hopefully you come back. Hopefully you found some value, some entertainment, and spent a nice hour with us, and we see you in the future. If anybody out there listening today or listening when the show comes out on the podcast services out there, if you've missed any part of today's show and you want to catch up, this show will be made available sometime next week. And if you want to catch up with the previous episodes, you can always go, as I said earlier in the show, virtualguardian.com/event, or just go on any podcast service out there. So again, a big thank you to all our listeners for their support. And remember, everybody, when you're behind the shield, you're ahead of the game. Thanks, everybody.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.